Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 5:35 p.m. It is Tuesday, April 11th, 2017. Before we begin, I would like to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Matt Kern from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Kopp, Representative Reinbold, and my Vice Chair, Representative Panzer, and myself, Representative Clayman. I want to note for not only folks in the committee, which all seem to be making the most of it, for those in the room, and I recognize Representative Ledoux has joined us in celebration of House Bill 104, which was the civil settlement reporting requirement that passed unanimously in the House and passed earlier this morning in the Senate. There is ice cream in my office. All are welcome to partake. And that's in honor of the bill passing, and hopefully the governor will see the same way that both houses of the legislature have seen. We do have a quorum to do business, and our first and only order of business today is House Bill 170, the Alaska Securities Act Penalties Court Rules, sponsored by the House Labor and Commerce Committee. This is the second hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Here to continue to answer questions on the bill is Kevin Ansom, Director of the Division of Banking and Securities. Kevin, if you could please come to the table and identify yourself for the record. And I would just – oh, and I recognize Representative Tito is here as well as actually the sponsor of the bill. Actually, it's a Labor and Commerce Committee bill, but he's the chair of the Labor and Commerce Committee. And this is really an opportunity to ask questions. We have had a deadline of 5 o'clock today for amendments, and tomorrow we're planning to take up those amendments, but this is a chance to talk more about the bill and voice your questions and concerns, et cetera, et cetera. And if Representative Reinbold, you look like you're on the verge of a question. I had a question to get a little discussion. We had a lot of discussion at the last about the section in the bill that created the misdemeanor crime without a mental state, which is what, as I understand it, appears on page 92, lines 16, 17, and 18.
What page? I'm sorry.
Page 92. And this was the language, I believe, from our discussion, is the language that created a misdemeanor without a mental state. And so I'm pondering the merits of an amendment that just removes that language, which would basically mean there wasn't a misdemeanor without a mental state. But trying to get a little more discussion about that going and hear your thoughts. And I can see Representative Eastman is looking more energized now that we have a topic to think about.
You just have to
always
bring
helps
up an issue.
For the record, my name is Kevin Ansom, and I'm the director of the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development Division of Banking and Securities, and thank you for having me back. Thank you for asking the question about the criminal enforcement piece. I understand that you're looking at potentially taking out the language starting at the end of line 16, which says a person convicted of violating a regulation or order issued under this chapter may be fined but may not be imprisoned if the person did not know of the regulation or order. We've looked at this, and of course we won't oppose it. I do wonder if the result would be that then there wouldn't be a lesser penalty, but that then prison would be on the table for anybody that was convicted of violating a regulation or order.
Okay.
As opposed to this exception.
Any further comments? I mean, because I guess the concern that I had, which I heard from others in the committee, is the whole notion of having some lesser crime but have that without a mental state. I guess I had the sense that we weren't all that bothered by having a misdemeanor crime that wasn't something that wasn't a felony in the world of criminal enforcement, but there seemed to be a great deal of discomfort with having that as a mindless offense, if you will, for lack of better words.
Strict scrutiny.
Strict liability.
If I may, I just a question back, if I may.
Mm-hmm, sure.
The fact that this is in the intentionally section, it would be, and I can have our AAG respond to this because we looked at it as well, if there would be an interpretation that it would still be need to be an intentional requirement.
And I see Renee Wardlaw from the Department of Law is on the line. Ms. Wardlaw, did you have any, are you with us? Are you following the discussion? Do you have anything you might add on this topic?
Good evening. For the record, my name is Renee Wardlaw. I'm the Assistant Attorney General. Through the chair, I am following the discussion. I agree with Director Anthem that intentionally is currently the mental state for a felony crime. Currently, it's written that if someone were to violate the statute or an associated regulation, they would be liable for a Class C felony. And so Department of Law is comfortable with moving along with that. As I review page 92 and the applicable lines, I actually do not see a provision related to a misdemeanor. And so my interpretation and review of the law, which I think may have been misstated by myself in the previous hearing, is that there actually is no misdemeanor punishment currently in the law, meaning that if we did proceed with a criminal manner, it would only be for a felony, and we would have to prove that that particular wrongdoer did the act intentionally. So I think that that puts a higher mental state there. I think that that answers at least some of the concerns, excuse me, that were stated by this committee thus far.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you. So I think that does answer one question for us is there does not appear to be a misdemeanor offense in this penalty structure. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kopp.
So if you're not guilty of a felony, then it appears you can only be guilty of a violation. In other words, if you don't meet the C felony standard, it's basically because you didn't know of the regulation or order, and you would just be subject to a fine, and it'd be prosecuted as a violation, a civil offense, non-criminal. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is absolutely correct. Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. And then one more, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Representative Kopp.
92.
It appears then that violating any regulation of this chapter
page 92
is felony conduct if you did it on purpose. And is there an argument to be made that that all intentional violations rise to the level of felony prosecution? Or, I mean, I'm not as familiar with this whole section of law as you all are, and I'm just surprised that if there is the only mental state we have attached is intentionally, and that all violations would be considered felony, Class C felonies. So is there a place for misdemeanor or a lesser in here? It seems now we have this gap going from being a felony or a traffic ticket. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. And through the chair, we have a host of, I would say, punishment avenues available to us. We have administrative. Of course, we can take an administrative action if we have someone who violates the statute. We also have civil avenue available. That's your civil enforcement section. That's also, I believe, section 4556660. And then, of course, we have criminal. And so the intention is that if we did have someone who is a violator, the administrator, along with advisement from the Attorney General's office, would determine what was best based upon the facts. You are correct that if, in fact, we did choose the criminal avenue, that violator would have to be acting intentionally with regard to their action against investors or with regard to what in fact they did. So, in, for example, if they intentionally sold or offered a security to investors and that in fact was, you know, a junk bond or a security that had no value, we could in fact take a criminal action. But there would be other factors that we would consider to determine if an administrative action would be best, a civil action would be best, or a criminal. And so the intention really for the enforcement section is to have all of these avenues available so that when the administrator looks at the particular facts of the case, along with advisement from the Attorney General's office, she or he could make that decision accordingly.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first comment is with regards to the traffic ticket, at $100,000, that's one heck of a traffic ticket.
I shouldn't have used that.
I'm still a little bit murky on the earlier conversation with regard to knowing violation versus unknowing violation. As I'm listening to the conversation, simply looking at subsection A, if we're describing that a felony...
We're on page 92.
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Describing that the felony mentioned here necessitates an intentional violation, then clearly we're not talking about the felony. I got that part. But if we are dealing with a fine of $100,000 or up to $100,000, just the fact that someone made an intentional act but didn't necessarily know that that act was contrary to the chapter or contrary to these regulations, that seems to be still in the strict liability category, unless I'm missing something.
Do you want to take that, or do you want to have your... aid online, Ms. Wardlow, take that.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I may not be following you 100%, so forgive me. But under the criminal enforcement, the mens rea, so to speak, is intentional, except if there is a violation of a regulation or order, which is usually a lesser sort of issue. So there's basically, in essence, two different standards in there. And it basically keeps, one says you can go to jail, you can go to prison, the other one says no. So, and with the civil penalties, you're right, we're looking at, we'd like to see it increased up to $100,000 per violation. But that doesn't mean that that's what the division would use. We're pretty careful in how we assess civil penalties and really want the response to fit the activity. And I don't think that will change if we raise the amount that can be paid for a violation.
Follow-up, Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So through the chair, I'm trying to envision sort of an analogy that might work. One of the ones that comes to mind is, you know, I happen to be trespassing on someone's property, but there's no signs posted, so I don't know that it's necessarily their property that I'm trespassing. Now, it's true that my decision to go to that location was intentional, so I have obviously violated, but it wasn't a knowing violation. And so I'm wondering, in this type of situation, is there what would the requirement be for, you know, degree of negligence or something else? I would hope that it's not simply, you know, as it could appear, that you don't know that there's a regulation, you violate it, and now you're on the hook for perhaps a very large penalty.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we can look at a couple of the enforcement orders that we talked about earlier, and in some of them they've got quite egregious activities. And for those egregious activities, for instance, taking money from an ailing elderly Alaska halibut fisherman through cold calls, that even then only We only went after a civil penalty. We didn't go anything after anything criminal. The same with the people that came up from Texas and stole $3.1 million from our Alaskans. Again, even now, we did not propose a criminal penalty. So it is going to have to be an egregious sort of situation. I don't know, and I don't know if Ms. Woodraw would remember any of the criminal cases. We haven't had very many criminal cases in the state of Alaska right now, but we also haven't had the tools to deal with the enforcement that this act would give us. So I'm afraid I can't give you any good examples here.
Follow-up? Representative Eastman, follow-up.
And perhaps this is for the Assistant Attorney General. I'm curious, are there any other elements to the offense other than strict liability and a regulation was violated? Is there any degree of negligence or anything else like that that would normally be required in order to issue a fine in this type of situation?
Ms. Wardlaw?
Yes, hopefully you can hear me through the chair. If you look at...
Say your name, too, just so the recording secretary keeps track.
Sure, hopefully you can hear me. So if you look at Section 45...
Right, but who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry, through the record, it's Assistant Attorney General Renee Wardlaw.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So if you look at Section 4556-670, again, the mental state is still intentionally. And so that last line of 670A really allows for us to have, I would say, a lighter version of a felony. In the event that someone who violates the law did not know about the law or the regulation associated with the law, they are not, they cannot be in prison. So that's really what that last line is there for. So just even if I go back, and hopefully this is clearer, it is a Class C felony if someone, in fact, violates the law. And they can either be imprisoned or they can have a fine up to $100,000. But in the event that they did not know about the law, they can only be fined up to the $100,000, but they cannot be imprisoned. So I think that what's happening is we're using the word knowingly, and that has some legal meaning. But in this case, we're just simply saying if someone doesn't know the law, then they are not subject to imprisonment. But they are, in fact, subject to the fine. So I hope that that adds some clarity.
Representative Ledoux.
Okay, well, I was starting off to think about why do you have to have the knowledge of something in order to have committed a crime. I mean, usually mens rea is that you actually intend to do something, not that you know whether it's legal or illegal. And then I started to think about this further. Is there anything else in which an agency adopts a regulation and it's the agency regulation that sets forth an actual criminal act? I mean, don't we as the legislature usually decide what are crimes and not crimes? So, you know, I get it, you know, in A, we're on 912, a person who intentionally violates this chapter. Got that. But then it says, a regulation adopted under this chapter or an order issued under this chapter is guilty of a Class C felony. So I guess I always thought that it would be the legislature who is going to actually determine what a crime was and that you couldn't actually commit a crime. I mean, a real honest to goodness that you could actually go to jail kind of a crime or lose big amounts by, because that was the legislature's prerogative, is other than securities law, other than this bill, is there any place else that we let the agency decide what is a criminal act?
Go ahead. The chair, Representative, I'm not, I don't I would have to look. I haven't tried to answer that question. I don't know if Ms. Wardlaw would know that off the top of her head with some of her other experience or not.
Because I'm really uncomfortable with the idea of letting, you know, an agency determine what is a crime.
Representative Reinbold.
Thank you, and I want to follow up to Representative Ledoux, and then I have three questions that are related to one another.
Go forth.
Thank you. Okay, so first of all, can you once again tell me who would make this decision, whether it's a felony or not? Which commission is this that you would be making this decision? Or agency, would it be?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, it would be the Department of Consumer, Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and it would be through and working with the Attorney General's office because that's the attorney for the state.
So no court or anything's involved at all?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, of course there would be a court involved. There would be, and I'm sure that Ms. Wardlaw can give us the full panoply of what happens, but there has to be something filed in court. There has to be a trial before someone is.
So that's what I was following up on her. Did you follow that? So you guys would just file the charges, or how would this process work?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, yes, the charges would be filed by the Attorney General's office. Or the appropriate law enforcement agency.
Okay, and then it would actually proceed just as a regular court case.
Through the chair, Representative Whitebolt, that's my understanding.
Anyway, that's what I was following up. Let's let her take the question, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman.
That's fine. Representative, go ahead.
Even though it proceeds like a regular court case, you guys actually create the crime through a regulation, not through, you know, going in front of a legislative committee and saying that A, B, and C should be elements of a crime. And I'm still really uncomfortable with that.
Well, I think that to the extent we pass this bill with this section in it, I think we are creating the crime by this, and what they're doing is not creating the crime. They're creating the regulations that say what do you have to do, and then if you don't do it, that becomes a crime. I don't think this gives them authority to write regulations defining crimes differently than what we're saying right here. But I may be off too.
Dialogue, Mr.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Representative Ledoux.
Well, if it's nothing other than what's here in this bill, then we don't need a regulation on it.
Can I speak?
I mean, obviously, it's giving the department authority to take this chapter and construe it in such a way that you could end up with a felony for violating a regulation. And I got problems with that.
Can I speak to that, too?
Well, first, because this is getting the whole room is lit up.
On dialogue.
Well, I know. We're kind of in dialogue, but we're also asking questions.
You approve dialogue.
This is between me and Representative Ledoux right now, but we're going to go back to the... We're going back to the Kevin Anselm. Go ahead, Kevin.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I don't know that this gives the department any more authority to issue regulations than in any other situation. I do believe that if someone violates a regulation, there is and should be a panoply of things that can happen to that person. The regulations have to arise from the law. The regulations do go through a process by which they're vetted. Before they are in place. So I don't know that that's any different than any other, and unfortunately I don't have a good example to give you right this moment.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ledoux, further questions?
Well, presumably we don't let the Department of Public Safety, you know, we have laws against murder, we've got laws against robbery, we've got laws against, you know, lots and lots of things. But I don't think we let the Department of Public Safety, you know, come up with their own interpretations of things and, you know, through regulations say one thing or another. I mean, that's just something for us to do.
Through the chair, Representative Liu. And there is always, I mean, there would be a judge involved in any sort of criminal activity.
That's not the issue that she's raising. The question she's raising is whether the department can issue a regulation that becomes a crime, or does the only authority to create offenses for which a person can be imprisoned in Alaska is that limited to the legislature to create the crime. We can make it a crime to violate the regulation, but if the regulation itself creates a crime, that's the question I think she's asking. She's nodding her head. Apparently, I got that much right.
Through the chair, Representative Liu and Chair, I don't know if there are situations where there are crimes that are basically established through regulation. Again, I don't know if Ms. Wardlaw would have that information off the top of her head or not, but if she does, I'll ask if she may be recognized.
Ms. Wardlaw, do you have anything to ask? Add? Not ask, but to add.
Sure. Thank you. Through the chair, again, for the record, it's Assistant Attorney General Renee Wardlaw. I would simply add that this language, for that first line that Representative Liu pointed out, is model language. We recognize that that may or may not fit the Alaska State Legislature and the authority that your body has. And so I can tell you in a practical sense that I sincerely doubt the division would take a criminal action if someone did not violate a statute outlined in this chapter, and for what would be 4556. And so if the committee was uncomfortable with us taking criminal enforcement against the regulation that was adopted under the chapter or an order issued under this chapter, we recognize that that probably wouldn't practically make a difference in our toolkit of enforcement ability.
All right. Representative Reinbold, appreciate your patience.
Thank you. I will tell you, once in a blue moon, Representative Liu and I actually really agree on something, and this is an issue we really agree on.
I must be doing something wrong.
Basically, actually this afternoon I was reviewing regulations for the Department of Education, and I used to be the chair of Admin Reg Review, and I have to say I would probably co-sponsor legislation with my friend here on the left in regards to administrative law. I am not a big fan of them going back months or years sometimes later and writing regulations. They never sat through the committee meeting. They don't know our intention. A lot of times regulations are not put in a timely manner. The regulations that I was reading this afternoon should have been done a year ago, and I'm very frustrated with the regulation process. We did get that law through the Admin Reg Impact Act that was almost passed unanimously. Still, it's not being followed very well at all, and I actually think regulations should be written when the law is done, not a month or 2 months or behind closed doors somewhere. So I actually strongly agree in regards to this area. So that's the issue on the regulations, but if I could divert back to asking my questions to her. Okay, so I warned you that I was going to ask you these questions ahead of time. At least one of them, and the other ones I hope you'll be able to answer. But can you please state the organization that encouraged this law to be brought before the body for transparency purposes for the public?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the original bill that was presented, actually it's been presented a number of times to the legislature, mm-hmm. has generally come up through the division mm-hmm. of banking and securities through the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and has several times been introduced as a governor's bill.
Okay, that's not my question. I know that. No, we talked before the meeting, and there was something like National Conference of Commission on Uniform State Laws. That's what I was urging you, because I have a couple questions about that. So if you could get that organization on record. And that if we have any state membership or any state representation?
through the chair, Representative Reinbold, it is a national conference of commissioners on uniform state laws, also known by its acronym NACUSL. And they do a number of uniform state laws. None of the states belong to this organization. But it's kind of considered a learned group of scholars from across the country in various disciplines, everything from probate law to securities law to estate law, and there's probably more. If I brought them up on the computer system right now, I'd give you there's several pages of different laws that they work with. And they also, they suggest to states that they make their laws uniform so that it is easier for businesses to move from state to state and to operate from state to state so that there's not very different laws from one to another state.
Through the chair, can I continue?
Go ahead, Representative Reinbold.
Okay, so, I mean, as I mentioned before, which I just want to get on record, I'm a fan of state sovereignty and federalism, which is state control. So I've seen so many bills. It's unbelievable that are all complying with the federal regulations, with the federal government, with everything uniform. I mean, I guess I like our independence. I like our state sovereignty. So with that, I want to know this National Conference of Commission on Uniform State Laws. You said there's no membership and no representative from the state. Do you know if there's any organizations, these scholars, does any organization fund them or any type of lobbying? Is any type of lobbying involved in any way?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, not that I'm aware of.
Before you follow up, just to clarify, this is the same, it's the Uniform Commission on Uniform Laws is the same one that brought us the revised Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act. We tend to see uniform laws come forward on a regular basis through that process, of which Alaska is one of, all 50 states are members of the group. But okay. Go ahead with your follow-up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're the right person to ask. Can you bring us information about this? Do you know how they're funded? Do you know why, if they're, what do you know about the organization? Basically, if this is the second law, do you know? Oh, that'd be awesome.
I'm more than happy. I know a bit, but Representative Kopp knows. Representative Kopp, if you want to explain what you know about the Commission on Uniform Laws, I know, for example, Deborah Baer is one of the Alaska commissioners was one of the designated Alaska commissioners on the Commission on Uniform Laws, and there's a number of folks that are retired but are still active. I mean, there's like four or five or six from Alaska that are involved in the group. But Representative Kopp, why don't you explain more about the group in answer to Representative Reinbold?
So, yeah, it's a good question, Representative Reinbold. The Uniform Law Commission was established, I think, over 50 years ago now. And my experience directly with it has to do with interstate extradition acts for people with felony warrants, how states agree to extradite offenders who are wanted in other states on felony warrants or an extraditable offense, and whether or not those states will extradite. The other thing they set uniform laws on are child custody. And I've had a lot of experience in my public safety career with the uniform laws that apply to child custody cases, depending on where the child was born, if the custodial parent is from the state that's making a claim for the child, or if the custodial parents have moved. And there's all kind of factors that states have got together to work out and says, if in situation A, if these factors apply, then this is how we, the states, are going to resolve it without fighting, basically. And but it is a long-established commission. There's nothing nefarious or anything hidden in there. It's been necessary for the states to be at peace with one another, to resolve a whole list of administrative things that otherwise would literally be a lawsuit every time. So it's the way that we interact in commerce, administrative, family, and criminal law dealings, and it's very effective. Thank you for that, Liberty.
Sure. Follow-up,
and
follow-up with regard to the Uniform Law Commission, or are we moving on to a different topic?
No, the same. So I wasn't saying anything nefarious or not. I'm not putting that type of a judgment. I just ask a very simple question.
Sure.
Do we have state representation? It sounds like there is commissioners, like Deb Baer. Well, I thought that they just said there was no state membership and no state representation. So getting a little bit to me, this is important in any organization that oversees it, I think. Asking very basic questions.
Sure, and Representative Reinbold, what I would actually suggest, those are actually really good questions. What I'm more than happy to do is, rather than try to vet this out when no one, I mean, the question about what does the Uniform Laws Commission do, actually, Ms. Anselm is really not the person to answer that question, probably the best person to answer it, and it would have been a good question for when we were taking up the Fiduciary Asset Act, which came from the Uniform, it was a Uniform Laws Act. So rather than try to answer all the questions and we don't have the right person to answer them, I'm more than happy at another point in time to bring somebody in, but I think we should focus on this particular act today.
And
I'm happy to talk with you more off record. I just don't think we need to spend
the time
on it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the reason is she said that they brought this bill forth. And I think it's very important to know the origin of bills that get brought before us for transparency. This was more for the public than for me.
Okay.
But I think it's very, very important that we know where, you know, if they came from ALEC or NCSL Uniform Commission.
And Representative Reinbold, I think that question has been answered, which is that where the structure of the bill started was from the Uniform Laws Commission, and she's been very clear at explaining that. But I don't think we need to try to have Ms. Anselm discuss the Uniform Law Commission because she's not actively involved in it. Any further questions, Representative Reinbold? Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I think just kind of in summary on that discussion, it's probably the language on lines 13 and 14, page 92, that we could just take a look at, like Representative Ledoux had mentioned, if we could be promulgating regulations by an administrative agency that could end up felonizing conduct, you know, we could look and see if we actually want that language in the chapter. It sounded like the Department of Law could probably live with it or without it. But what I would hope is that if conduct was felony, it would be felony because we're dealing with laws pertaining to the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. And there are many of those laws, as you know, Mr. Chairman, which are felonies. And if we're actually basing this on United States Code, which does say whether something's a felony or not, then there could be a good reason for having some leeway in there as long as it was tied to conduct that was already a federal felony. But because we're unclear like that about that, you know, maybe we could I don't know if now's the time to visit that or later, but
one of the suggestions I was going to make on that topic is, I didn't think that was a question from Ms. Anselm, which is why I'm
talking with you as an attorney.
My thought is, because this is up for tomorrow with amendments, I've already had to draft an amendment with regard to subsection A on page 92. My thought is that we may want, and I actually saw John Skidmore in the Capitol earlier today, and which makes me think he'll be here tomorrow because he seems to come for weeks at a time. But the sensible thing may well be to get somebody from the Department of Law Prosecution to come tomorrow to get his input on this, because I think we actually have delved into the realm that's more typically the prosecutor's realm, unless the securities regulation, which is what Ms. Anselm's. Did you have other follow-up? But that's what I would suggest we'll have tomorrow to discuss some of these things as we take up potential amendments to this subsection, because clearly is making everyone on the committee somewhat uncomfortable, curious, worried, a whole bunch of different adjectives, and I won't try to characterize everyone's individual senses. So I have a couple of questions on this, because I'm not sure whether these are from Ms. Wardlaw or others. But as I read subsection A right now, a person who is charged under this felony provision would be subject to a fine of up to $100,000, but not imprisonment under this kind of language in the last sentence about if the person didn't know of the regulation or ever order. Am I reading that correctly, that it would be up to $100,000 fine?
Yes.
Okay. So this is where it gets real confused. Well, okay. Actually, Representative Ledoux has a question. I'm going to let Representative Ledoux ask her question, and then I'll continue with my concerns. Representative Ledoux.
So it seems to me that there's something somewhere, and maybe I'm wrong about this, that anything that has a fine over X amount of dollars is a felony, and if it's less than $5,000, it's a misdemeanor. I mean, it actually, $100,000, as Representative Eastman said, that is one hell of a traffic fine. I understand, Representative Kopp, it's a maximum, but it's, I mean, there are, I know what I'm thinking. Okay, so there are certain protections that you get when you're charged with either a felony or a misdemeanor. And those protections, foremost of them, are the right to a jury trial. Well, if something is simply a violation, you don't get your right to a jury trial. I mean, so that seems somewhat problematic to me, that somebody can get fined up to $100,000 and they don't have the right to a jury trial.
That was my point earlier.
Due process.
Is that a question or a comment?
I guess I'm going off and Representative Copps pointed to, I think, the Sixth Amendment.
And, Mr. Chair.
Hold on, wait. Representative Reinhold, go ahead.
That was something I was referring to earlier. So that's when I ask about the trial. So anyway, I think that she, once again, that's twice in a day. This is kind of a miracle today.
Well, to try to get to some more of the complicated miracles that are happening. That's why we come to the Grinberg Room for miracles, to come from above.
And
ice cream, as long as it's good ice cream. Anyway, to make it even more complicated, the way the last sentence in subsection A reads, this is actually not a misdemeanor provision. It's a felony provision because the sentence starts out, a person convicted of violating a regulation or order under this chapter. So the only conviction can be for the felony. And so now you have this conviction for a felony, which actually requires that you intentionally violating the chapter. And I will say that intentional violation of a law means, under the traditional construction in the criminal statutes, means knowledge of the thing you're violating. You have to know that it's illegal you have to know it's illegal to break into somebody's house. I'm not trying to get securities, but you've got to have knowledge of the circumstances. Hold on. But the problem is, now you have this thing you're trying to say, you don't know about the regulation order, but that's the very thing you're supposed to know about to make an intentional violation. And so now I'd see this problem with this last sentence, because how can you be convicted of intentional action if you don't know of the regulation or order? But that's a question that either I want to get Ms. Wardlaw or Ms. Anselm to answer, and then Representative Ledoux gets a chance to ask the next hard question. Can you answer that question?
Through the chair, I'm going to go ahead and defer to Renee. So you've already heard my response.
Okay.
I do. If I may, though, I don't think there's going to be that many criminal actions arise from this act. There are civil violations, and there are also the administrative violations. So I understand why you're focusing here, but I wanted you to know that there's a whole panoply in this law of actions that the division, in concert or not with the Attorney General's office, can take. And then I wanted to defer to Renee.
Ms. Wardlaw, sorry. Getting my people confused. Ms. Wardlaw.
Through the chair, again, Assistant Attorney General Renee Wardlaw, in reference to 670, I'll defer to what I said a few moments ago about criminal liability for a violation of a regulation or an order. I recognize, based upon this discussion, that if, in fact, that language was deleted from line 13, that states a regulation adopted under this chapter or an order issued under this chapter, going into line 14, then it seems that language that we've been discussing in lines 16 through 18 would become null and void. if in fact we only associated criminal liability with the violation of a section of the chapter, meaning statutory language, then it really becomes irrelevant if someone knows about a regulation or an order issued under this chapter. So I offer that to this committee as potentially an amendment. I know that that will be discussed tomorrow, and I certainly will be available tomorrow for answering questions and otherwise. But I think that may very well be a solution, and certainly a solution that Department of Law is comfortable with.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I was just going to respond to your comment, Mr. Chairman, that you actually, in order to be guilty of something, you have to know that it's against the law. I mean, you couldn't say, well, you know, I'm from a country which practices cannibalism, and I come to the United States, and I don't realize that cannibalism is against the law. I mean, I think the intent, I mean, the mens rea is you actually have to know what you're doing. I don't think you actually have to know that it's against the law. So that if you're I mean, for example, there are countries that practice honor deaths. I mean, you can't come to the United States and kill your kid because she's fooling around and say, well, in my country, you know, where I came from, this is perfectly okay, and expect to be exempted from the law because you don't know it. Isn't mens rea kind of not knowledge of the law, but you knowingly intended to do something, and knowledge actually that it's illegal or not has nothing to do with it?
Well, to dialogue on that topic, and then we may not go all along because we're really getting way off the securities bill into. But I think, Representative Ledoux, the distinction that you're raising is one between what they call malum in se offenses versus malum prohibitum offenses. So the kinds of things you're talking about with killing your child because that's the custom, or cannibalism because that's the custom in another culture, is conduct that, at least in our country, we think that's wrong in and of itself, or malum in se, whereas the notion that kind of knowing misrepresentations by not putting specific information in a securities disclosure is wrong, not because it's inherently wrong, but because we have laws that say when you do a security disclosure, these are the five things you're supposed to say. And so because that's at least in theory, those are less inherently known to be, they're not as inherently known to be improper. That's why you get into the malum prohibitum, and that's where you get into the question of knowledge about the fact that that particular conduct is illegal, as opposed to, I mean, killing the neighbor is clearly illegal, unless it's self-defense. But if I'm, you know, like in a tax return, you'd have to be able to show knowledge of what you're actually supposed to be reporting to be able to show that that's enough to be a criminal conduct. So I have a note from all the notes that have been passing. I will note. The first was that apparently in the current statute of Title 45, there's a lot of intentional language similar to what's in subsection A, and that the chair of the Labor and Commerce Committee will bring tomorrow a list of the different offenses that are involved that are based on intentional violations and how that works, so we have a little bit bigger picture of that. That's sort of a suggestion that we then use that as a segue to sort of get back to the specifics of the bill rather than the broader philosophical points. Is there an interest in going through a sectional in the bill, or do we want to? Where does the committee wish to go? We're coming up on 6:30. I don't feel like we have to push on forever and ever tonight. But I have a note from Representative Reinfeld. There's a lot of Latin we've been bantering back and forth. Do you want me to talk about those offline, or do you want to hear it now?
You are the chair.
No. Oh, the recording secretary. Okay. So there's some Latin phrases. It is malum in se. So malum, and I don't want to spell mal. I want to say M-A-L-U-M, but that's probably wrong. In a second word, in se, S-E is the third word. So malum in se is a Latin phrase that means essentially evil in and of itself, by the act itself. And malum prohibitum, prohibitum being some variation of prohibited, where prohibited came from. So malum prohibitum is evil because we've decided that it is an issue of law or regulation that says so. And so one is, for example, you start with the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill thy neighbor except in self-defense. That's malum in se. Malum prohibitum would be thou shalt pay your taxes every year and fill out your tax returns and truthfully report your income. And if you have a pattern of knowingly not disclosing that, that would be malum prohibitum. Those are the two Latin terms that we've been bandying about. Representative Ledoux.
Are those legal terms? Because I actually don't remember them from law school.
Yes.
They are.
Thank you.
They are in there. So is there anyone that's interested in us going through a sectional on the sectional analysis, or we just want to gavel on and come back tomorrow and take up amendments? Everyone seems mostly focused on page 90, frankly.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we did get through it at a high level before, and I'm comfortable going to amendments.
Okay. I don't see anyone looking for more sectional analysis, and we did do sectional analysis at the last meeting. I'm looking at the staff from the Labor and Commerce Committee.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe we did. I think we just did the high-level points, but... did we? Or, oh, no, we did with you, didn't we, through your presentation at a high level, correct?
Through the chair, we went through a PowerPoint, an actual sectional. We went through many of the sections, but we didn't go through all the sections.
And I would suggest if you want a more detailed analysis of the sections, unless the whole committee is looking for that, I would suggest you get Kevin to come by your office.
Mine was just a comment.
Oh, comment is fine. Go ahead.
No, I made it.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, I don't see anyone wanting the sectional. I don't see any further discussion today. We will hold House Bill 170 at this time for further review. I know we received three amendments. One of them does address issues in Section A on page 92. We will plan to take up those amendments to House Bill 170 at tomorrow's meeting, and so with that we will be adjourning for the day. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, April 12th at 1 p.m. We will start out with hearing House Bill 208, Trusts, Community Property Trust, Powers of Attorney, sponsored by Representative Johnson, and House Bill 175, U.S. President-elect Popular Vote Compact, sponsored by Representative Fansler. The Popular Vote Compact, we will only be hearing invited testimony. We will not be hearing public testimony. I think we will try to open up the trusts and community property trusts for public testimony, although I suspect the public testimony that will be fairly limited. And we will also take up amendments to House Bill 170. And we will not, although the plan had been earlier to take up House Bill 200, which is the open primary, tomorrow, just because of time constraints and everything else, we're going to actually take that up, House Bill 200. We will now be having public testimony on that on Friday.
Okay. Mr. Chair, you had mentioned House Bill 76 at some point. When might we be getting back to that, right? 76?
79.
No, sorry, 79. Sorry, yeah.
Our goal is to take up amendments to House Bill 79 on Thursday.
Thank you.
Representative Reinbold.
Okay, so we were going to do public testimony. I believe it was on 200 tomorrow, but that's being moved to Friday. Is that
exactly
correct? At 1 o'clock?
Yes.
Okay.
Given that I'm pausing at the time because I know we're not always starting at the same time, I had to think to make sure I'm tracked.
We get it.
Any other comments? Hearing and seeing none, we will stand adjourned. It is now 6:30 p.m.